Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, this is Blog. Good morning, folks. This is Gigabit Nation. I want to welcome everyone to the show today. I'm your host, Craig Settles. And this year has been very interesting in the gigabit fiber network arena, thanks in no small part to Chattanooga and the Kansas cities, Kansas City, Missouri, Kansas City, Kansas. Chattanooga is a great success early out of the gate with their network, and the two Kansas cities are success stories waiting to happen. Now, the big question is, will San Francisco be the next gigabit city? The San Francisco story actually began percolating a couple of months ago when Sonic.net announced that they were building a gigabit network in Sebastopol, which is in Northern California, and that service would be a gig service for $70 a month. Then later down the road, we got the word that Sonic.net was selected by Google to manage their network, Google's network, at Stanford University, and that started a little bit of a buzz going. And then last week, we heard that San Francisco may be Sonic.net's next major coup. So today, we have the man behind the buzz, Sonic.net CEO Dane Jasper. So without further ado, let's get on with the show. Dane, welcome to Gigabit Nation.
Thank you, Craig.
And let's start with a little background on Sonic.net. You guys have been around for how long?
We were founded in 1994 as a good old-fashioned dial-up internet service provider. And you know, in the early days of Unix shell access, and evolved to become a DSL resale provider using AT&T's DSLAMs, and we've been pretty successful in that. We provide that in retail, and also we operate an open aggregation network for about 70 other smaller internet service providers around California and in a 13-state footprint. And then in 2006, we became a carrier and began a facilities-based deployment of our own DSLAM and POTS voice infrastructure.
Mm-hmm. So for the layperson, what's a DSLAM? Because a lot of our audience are going to be people involved with broadband, but not necessarily on the technology or the carrier side of things.
The DSLAM is the DSL access multiplexer. So, you know, where you have copper infrastructure and you're utilizing DSL, the equipment in the central office or cabinet is called a DSLAM. And in our case, it's a multi-service aggregation platform, or MSAP, that manages ADSL 2+. We have the capability to do VDSL, and that's planned for next year. POTS voice, plain old telephone service, so standard landline, battery-powered voice services, as well as carrier Ethernet products. And today, in the carrier segment of our business, about a third of the business is carrier Ethernet products. So those are multi-pair, generally symmetric products. We offer, you know, anywhere from T1 speed up to a 30 megabit symmetric product. So that's an enterprise product targeted at sort of medium to large enterprise businesses. And we have a lot of customers that utilize those products out of the MSAP/DSLAM as well.
So, and you mentioned that you provide services in other states as well as California?
We are not facilities-based beyond California. We provide DSL aggregation services on a resale basis on AT&T's DSLAMs outside of California.
Okay.
And we have an array of service providers who will use us to serve their customers in those regions. And I think the majority of them are California ISPs that have, you know, most of their customers in California, then they have some number of folks out of state.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's really, I think, sort of three primary generations of product for us. The resale of AT&T DSLAMs, you know, we began that in 1998, And as I said, we do that for about 70 service providers over this 13-state footprint. Then beginning in 2006, we have our facilities-based deployment where we're putting our own electronics on the end of the copper unbundled network elements, the local loop unbundling, where we lease only the copper, and we put our equipment on it and create and operate the products. So that's sort of the second generation. And then the third generation is the fiber products, where we're building outside plant all the way out to the customer premise. And that's obviously relatively new. We launch products, the 100 megabit and 1 gigabit products in Sebastopol this year. And that's sort of the next step for us, is to move beyond the copper to owned and operated facilities all the way to the premise.
Mm-hmm. So let's talk about the Sebastopol network. So that is a gig service for $70 a month, right?
Yes. Our product philosophy is to craft one set of products that deliver over copper everything that we're capable of delivering, and then segue those to fiber. And today in Sebastopol, we have about 30% market share there. So the transition to fiber is, to a great degree, driven by both market share and market growth. And so the primary product offering, this is a product we call Fusion Broadband and Phone, and the primary product offering is one phone line with unlimited nationwide calling, free calls to Canada. Those are limited to 8 hours, so it's not unlimited internationally. All the voice features, so, you know, voicemail with unified inbox. It'll put the voicemail into your email inbox, SMS notifications, Twitter notifications. So it's a next-generation voicemail platform, caller ID, three-way calling, and call waiting, and all the voice features you'd expect. So we deliver everything we can on the voice platform. And then alongside that, the copper ADSL 2+, so the fastest possible DSL technology for the length of the customer's loop, and that product delivers up to 20 megabits over copper. And there aren't different speed tiers, there aren't different prices. We deliver the full potential speed, whatever maximum speed it will synchronize at, and there aren't any consumption caps. We really feel like people want to use a lot of internet, they should use it. And we deliver the combination of that unlimited voice line and unlimited broadband. We sell for $39.95. As the market share has increased, the idea is to replace that copper provision service with a fiber provision service at the same price point. So we take the one phone line and up to 20 megabit copper delivered service, and we replace it with one phone line delivered over fiber and broadband delivered over fiber at 100 megabit for $39.95. We also have a two-line product. The two-line product delivers two phone lines. We find this is mostly being purchased by folks that have a home office and they'd like a reliable landline for their outgoing calls, in addition to a home line. And so we deliver two phone lines, and then we bond the broadband between the two. So that allows us to deliver over copper an up to 40 megabit broadband service, and we sell that for $69.95. And that segues into a two phone line over fiber and 1 gigabit service. So we've got this one price path towards fiber philosophy, where we'll provision everything we can on copper, and then as uptake in the market, as demand in the market increases, then we would replace that with fiber over time. And we really think that price point is less important than market share, particularly in fiber. And I think that's been one of the questions we've seen is, you know, why aren't we charging more for the fiber? And fundamentally, you know, if you capture 5% market share after building a fiber infrastructure, the economics don't work. So it has to be an aggressively priced product. And that's something that we haven't seen from, you know, others who've built fiber, you know, whether it's Verizon with their Fios product or Chattanooga EPB. The market penetration is a challenge. You know, I believe that the price should be ridiculously low in order to drive market penetration, and that, you know, that's the key success factor when you're building infrastructure that passes all these premises.
So, but then what about the issue of trying to make a profit? I mean, as we, the general consumer, kind of understand the dynamic, you know, a company builds a bunch of fiber or a community builds a bunch of fiber infrastructure, it costs them X. And at some point, they got to recapture X, and they recapture it by selling services at whatever the price point is. And I think the first thought that would come to someone's mind is that, well, if that's the nature of the beast, if I spend $1 million for infrastructure, I've got to get it back in subscriptions. If I only charge $70, then it appears that the company's strategy is they will make their money back through volume sales, not necessarily by selling a few subscribers at, you know, $1,000 a month or $2,000 or whatever per month. Is that a correct read, or am I missing something?
Yeah, it's the market uptake is the primary factor. You know, fundamentally, the cost of building these infrastructure-heavy networks is very high, and it's very high as an opportunity cost. So the way that we look at the economics of building fiber to the home, it ends up being somewhere between $500 and $1,000 per home passed, which is a cost of opportunity. You know, whether or not you serve that customer is about, you know, your marketing and your product positioning and pricing. And, you know, to make it very clear, if you were in the worst case to spend $1,000 per home passed and you got 10% market uptake, you've spent $10,000 to serve one customer who might be giving you, you know, $200 a month, or I think, you know, some folks are charging as much as $350 for a 1 gigabit residential mm-hmm. product. And if you're only serving a tiny, tiny percentage of the customers, you know, no matter how high the amount is, it's very difficult to create an ROI on that kind of capital investment. If instead you sell the product for $40 for a 100 megabit service or $69.95, $70 for a 1 gigabit service, and you can get 50% market adoption. So now if you're spending $1,000 per home passed and you've got 50% market uptake, you've spent $2,000 per home served, neglecting some of the costs of actives, which are dropping and becoming less of a factor. But, you know, the point is if you're able to bill $50 a month over a $2,000 capital investment, you know, versus $350 a month over a $10,000 capital investment, you know, the number of customers is much more important than the monthly rate. And an aggressive monthly rate presumably means a lot of customers.
Mm-hmm.
The other factor that I think we've seen a lot of questions about is bandwidth consumption and, you know, what the consumption of bandwidth does to costs. And I think there's a perception among consumers that's been, you know, created by carriers that, you know, the more you use, the more it costs them to serve. And that is true, but it is marginal.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, if we look at our 17-year history as a internet service provider, the cost of bandwidth, whether it's middle-mile transport or edge transit to the internet at exchange points, you know, and taking into consideration, you know, peering opportunities and, you know, all the different ways we are able to clear traffic, the cost of internet transit and transport as a percentage of customer revenue has only declined for 17 years running. And certainly the amount of bandwidth that people are consuming is on the increase, but our costs to carry it, whether across our network or at the edge, have declined more quickly than the pace at which people's consumption is increasing. And the other factor is that people don't use more bandwidth, consume on the inbound, more bandwidth just because they have more potential to do so. And this is really clearly illustrated when we look at tiered products. So you look at an ADSL1 product where, you know, common bandwidth tiers are like 1.5 and 3 and 6 megabit. And statistically, when we study those customers, the people who are at 6 megabit use more bandwidth. But the reason for that isn't that they have a bigger potential size of the delivery mechanism. It's the fact that those customers chose to spend more money. So where you're offering a 1.5 megabit product that might nominally be, you know, $25, $30, $35 is sort of the market rate across the U.S., versus a 3 megabit product, twice the speed, is going to cost $5 to $10 more. A 6 megabit product is going to cost $5 to $10 more on top of that. And the consumer who chooses to spend more for their broadband turns out to be the kind of consumer for whom broadband is more important and they use more.
Mm-hmm.
But in the Fusion product, where we just sell uncapped, unlimited, up to 20 megabit with a phone line for $39.95, there's no self-selection of heavy consumers. And what we find is that nominally everybody uses a moderate amount. And when we take those customers and move them to fiber at 100 megabit, or we take the 2 line and move them to 1 gigabit, we don't find that their usage skyrockets. You know, just because they have the potential to go much faster, you know, they still only have a certain number of screens in the home. They still only have a certain amount of hard drive space to download things onto. And they're more satisfied because what they ask for arrives in moments instead of minutes. But they don't suddenly then decide to consume a lot more. There's some nominal increase. You know, it's faster, so you have a tendency to do a little more. But it doesn't drive consumption or cost the way that you might presume that it would. And so that's been an interesting lesson as we've deployed both copper and fiber products.
Mm-hmm. Well, that definitely tackles what I consider one of the big, debates that have gone on. I think that because of the way the incumbents, the large carriers, have presented the argument, you know, it's always been about, you know, these, well, the bandwidth hogs. I mean, that whole myth of, you know, there's people out there that will just basically bring a network to its knees because you now have a gig option. And what you're really saying is that people have needs, and they stay relatively the same. If anything, they're more appreciative of the fact that stuff comes across faster, but their needs pretty much stay with what they are.
Yes. You know, I'd say generally speaking, we don't see a huge shift in consumer behavior just because we provide a faster connection.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I think that I published an article on my blog a month or so ago about congestion and capping that kind of dissects the rationale behind caps and dealing with the problem of congestion. You know, the technical issue is peak hour congestion. And that's what drives upgrades to the network. If everybody is downloading a bunch of stuff or streaming a bunch of entertainment content at 7 in the evening on a, you know, Wednesday night. That's going to be your peak hour. And hypothetically, you need to build the network to accommodate that peak hour behavior. And the consumers who consume a lot of bandwidth throughout the entire month probably do have some behavior during the peak hour. But the issue isn't them. It's that everyone else who generally makes lighter use of the network is, during your peak hour, hypothetically, a heavy user. And so punishing those who consume a large amount over a long period of time, while it might have a collateral effect of, you know, changing those folks' behaviors to some degree, you know, I would argue that it really has nothing to do with your peak hour congestion problem, and that there are better technical ways to manage congestion should it occur in a network. And, you know, in our network, we upgrade all of our transport, middle mile connections, and transit connections before they congest. But where there's congestion, you know, I would argue that the right way to manage congestion is to slow down the person who's going the fastest. You know, if you've got somebody who's bringing something in at 100 megabits or 150 megabits, and someone else wants to bring something in at 1.5 megabit, you know, statistically, you need to just slow down the fastest guy a bit until, you know, he or she is no longer impacting or impairing the network. And instead, you know, what the industry norm in the U.S. has become is, you know, if you download 150 or 250 gigabytes, then you either get kicked off the network or you pay a financial penalty. And and the financial penalty is disproportionate to the cost of that actual consumption. And I think both those steps are unreasonable. But, you know, in the case I make in the article that I published recently, is that, you know, fundamentally this is about protecting the pay television business model. And if consumers were able to stream enough content 24/7 to entertain the typical American household, and I don't remember the exact Nielsen stats, but you know, the stats for the most recent year I could find were something like 6 or 7, 8 hours a day worth of television is watched by the typical American household. I think I also read that the average household has more TVs than people. So, you know, a couple TVs are on. And, you know, when you add up that bandwidth, it's well more than 250 gigabytes every month. You know, particularly when you add in a little bit of high def and, you know, maybe eventually some 3D or something like that. And, you know, you're talking about, you know, a terabyte or more in order to replace the average entertainment of linear television, pay TV, in the average American household. And that's just the average. So, you know, there's households where the TVs are on a lot more, and obviously those less. But, you know, my argument is that, you know, caps are not rational from the perspective of costs in the network, nor management of congestion during peak hour, and that their primary function is to interfere with the potential for a streaming business model disrupting the pay television business space.
So, now with that particular piece of knowledge out, how does the consumer respond to that? What kind of leverage do we have? Because that's really what a lot of these debates that have been before the FCC and all the back and forth in Congress and just the general noise coming out of, I don't know, the Washington policy machine has always been about this whole thing of, you know, the bandwidth hogs are why we have to do X and why we have to do Y, and they're imploring the government to not interfere with their right to do X and Y. But then where does that leave the consumer? Do we all wait for enlightened companies to come in with less expensive service? Do we protest? I mean, what would you see as a consumer response?
You know, fundamentally, you know, most American consumers have relatively few broadband choices. And, you know, from what I've read, around the FCC's actions around net neutrality and obviously that debate in Congress and at the regulatory body. You know, fundamentally, it's about disclosure. And the cable companies, the telecoms that are providing access now are required to disclose to consumers how they're treating their bits. Are they transiting those bits across the network without slowdowns or management? Are they charging for consumption? And, you know, fundamentally, usage-based billing is a legitimate business model. And I would argue that it's a rational business model if you are in the business of selling pay television and you don't want everybody to stop buying television from you. The rational thing to do is to institute usage-based billing and preclude the possibility that people would replace their pay TV entertainment with streaming entertainment over the top. And so, you know, where we've settled in the regulatory environment in the U.S. is that if there is usage-based billing or caps, those need to be transparent and disclosed to the consumer. The consumer needs to have a mechanism whereby they can see how far along they are so that there isn't a bill shock at the end of the month if there's a consumption cap that involves a financial penalty. But, you know, what can consumers do about that? You know, well, you know, consumers have certainly agitated for transparency and I think achieved that. But, you know, if they don't like the business model, you know, the only solution is to patronize companies that are not capping. And it's a little challenging because, frankly, I think a lot of consumers aren't near the caps and therefore don't care about the caps. And so, you know, I think one of the major carriers was quoted as saying less than 3% of their customers would be affected by a 250 gigabyte cap. So that would imply that, you know, those 3% would care, and maybe those 3% would switch to another provider. But that just leaves the other provider, you know, it's a little bit like a health insurer ending up with the expensive-to-serve patients. You know, a service provider ends up with the consumer who consumes the most because they've got the policy of not capping, whereas the majority don't notice or don't care because they aren't running into it and it isn't a problem for them. And so, you know, I think on principle, consumers should try to patronize companies that are furthering policies that they agree with, whether those are privacy policies or consumption policies. You know, I think those are ways that you can speak with your wallet, so to speak. But not everyone in the U.S. has that opportunity. And so it could be that you're choosing from your local cable company or your local phone company. There might be a wireless ISP. You know, the wireless ISP might have caps in place as well or do bandwidth management. And so you may be left with little choice. And, you know, that's sort of the state of broadband in America today, unfortunately.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm going to probably come back to that one in a little bit, but I do want to talk about San Francisco since, number one, it's close to where I am, but also it raises the possibility that the next big gigabit city, not the Sebastopol is not a player, but you know, as larger cities go, San Francisco then would join the ranks of Chattanooga and the Kansas cities in terms of, you know, big cities with a gig or big cities poised to have a gigabit network. So tell us about the goings on in the city by the bay.
Yeah, San Francisco is a very exciting market for us. With the Fusion Broadband product that we deliver over copper, San Francisco is our fastest growing market today. We serve from 9 different telco exchanges there, and we have more customers adopting the Fusion Broadband phone service in San Francisco than anywhere else. And so it's a fast growing market for us, and that's a primary decision factor around the fiber overbuild that replaces the copper. I think it's an intriguing story from the perspective of, you know, fiber to follow. So copper first, and then fiber following as consumers uptake the copper products. And then also San Francisco is in the midst of a debate about the sightliness of street cabinets. And I think, you know, this is they've been going back and forth in you know, between the board of supervisors and the planning department for some time about cabinet deployment. And you know, I think it's important that that debate take into account that there may be competitors beyond the incumbents, and that that could mean more cabinets. And I think also we've got an interesting illustration in this deployment of, you know, a next generation future proof fiber product with a limited number of cabinets. The full plan for San Francisco contemplates about 188 cabinets, and these are you know, typically sidewalk mounted. They're 5 feet tall, about 2 feet deep, and about 4 feet wide. And electronics go in this cabinet in order to serve fiber that goes out to the premise. And that fiber to the premise can deliver, you know, in our footprint today, we offer that 1 gigabit product. So, you know, it's an exciting future-proof investment in infrastructure. With a moderate cabinet deployment, but for San Francisco, that is a subject of some debate because they're contemplating hundreds and hundreds of cabinets from being deployed by AT&T. So I reached out last week to the neighborhood associations in the form of the San Francisco Beautiful Group, and I talked to them about our deployment. And you know, obviously, they have some trepidations, you know, particularly around. If AT&T deploys, you know, 700 cabinets, you know, that's something they've had objection to, and they're in the midst of a lawsuit around that. But if a competitor comes along and wants to do another 188, you know, even if it's a superior product, that's additive, and of some concern. So, you know, we felt like it was really the right time to talk about that. I reached out to the Board of Supervisors a few months ago. And spoke with the member of the Board of Supervisors who was really instrumental in the decision to allow AT&T to proceed with their cabinet deployments. And I asked, you know, well, you know, what about the next guy? You know, will we receive similar treatment? And, you know, they were unable to really give me a firm answer. You know, it was a hypothetical situation. So we felt like it was appropriate to document that goal and make sure that we're in on that decision-making process in the near term rather than, you know, hypothetically in the future.
So is the deal that the AT&T cabinets, of which there are hundreds and hundreds, is that locked in, definite, no doubt about it kind of situation?
The current state as of now, you know, mid-December, 2011 here is that it is that the construction is stayed right now, and there's a lawsuit pending between the neighborhood associations and AT&T, and the City of San Francisco Board of Supervisors did give their support for the project, and cleared it to proceed some months ago, and construction did begin, but now has been stayed by the court, and so at the moment it's in the midst of this decision-making process about whether or not these cabinets are an environmental impact. Are they a visual blight in this urban environment? And, you know, they're particularly concerning, I think, because they're a magnet for graffiti and vandalism, and that's unsightly. They can also obstruct sidewalks, and, you know, you really don't want to, you know, further narrow the walking area or wheelchair access for folks, and so the question is, you know, is there an impact to the environment that is significant for these cabinets? And while most communities have allowed cabinets to be deployed around the U.S. And there's federal regulations that allow for cabinet deployments, you know, San Francisco's really been, you know, I think active in the debate around what those cabinets mean to the public, and what they mean from the perspective of visual blight or obstruction of walkways balanced against the delivery of next generation products. And I think it's an important and healthy debate.
So are we in a situation where these cabinets are necessary for all types of communication? Because clearly not everywhere where there are these cabinets we actually have fiber services. Or are they one and the same? I mean, you don't have the cabinets unless you have a fiber infrastructure. I guess maybe people need to understand where the cabinets come from initially, and are the cabinets for fiber infrastructure smaller, sleeker, whatever, than the cabinets for whatever else they're being built for?
So the cabinets that AT&T deploys, by and large, are for delivery of copper to the premise.
Hmm.
So this is a deployment technology called FTTN, or fiber to the node. The node is the cabinet, and then copper is used for the remaining portion from there to the premise. And, you know, that might be a few thousand feet nominally. And by bringing fiber most of the way to the home or premise, it's possible to deliver faster services. And but they do need to be pretty close to homes. And, you know, so if you look at the serving map, they need to be within a few thousand feet of all the homes. And there's a certain density of deployment in the cabinet. But it's still a DSL product. So it's DSL to the premise. It's just shorter length DSL. And our build-out philosophy is instead fiber to the premise, or FTTP, or if it's residential, FTTH, fiber to the home. And so for us, that means far fewer cabinets because we don't have the same distance limitations that the copper necessitates. You know, fiber can go much further, much faster, obviously. And so we only need about one quarter the number of cabinets in a deployment where cabinets are used to house the active electronics. So the infrastructure brings a small number of fibers to a cabinet. That's a point of aggregation. There's very high-speed links from there back to the rest of the network. And then from the cabinet, electronics which drive the optics, which connect to the fibers, which go directly to each home to serve the optical equipment in the home. And that style of infrastructure is a little less intensive in the cabinet quantity, effectively.
Are the cabinets the same size?
They're roughly equivalent, yes.
Okay.
You know, they might be you know, 6 inches or a foot skinnier or fatter for one or the other, but you know, basically what's in the cabinets is pretty similar. In the fiber cabinets, there obviously isn't all the copper cross-connecting, and that takes some space because you have to have fusing protection to protect the electronics. So there's some more space in a copper infrastructure that's required. So fiber gains some benefits because it's a little bit smaller just physically. But I would say the cabinet that houses a couple thousand people in a fiber-to-the-premise environment is pretty similar to a cabinet that might house, you know, give or take 500 people in a copper deployment.
Right. So you said, okay, so it's really just, it's primarily an issue of the quantity of them. And it sounds like then AT&T is looking to increase the number of cabinets so that it can increase the quality of its DSL delivery.
Yes. And,
okay.
And deliver faster service that allows for delivery of television. And
oh, right, the old TV thing.
Yeah, so that's the UVerse platform. And you know, this is it's a worthwhile network upgrade. It's in San Francisco, certainly long overdue. And you know, I think as a as a resident of the area, I certainly support the concept, and as somebody who's, you know, also hoping to deploy cabinets, you know, I think as a policy decision, we need to accept as a modern society that there will be infrastructure. You know, there are traffic signals. There are boxes that control the traffic signals. You know, there are boxes that deliver coaxial cable, cable TV, and cable broadband. You'll see cabinets up on poles. You'll see little lumps on people's lawns. You know, this is the natural, you know, infrastructure is a natural part of a modern landscape, and I think we need to accept that in some form, but we also need to make sure that it is not unsightly and unreasonable, and so there's a balance to be struck there that needs to take into account, you know, reliability of next generation products, maintainability, as well as the, you know, how ugly is it, and how can we mitigate it being ugly in the way, et cetera. And I think San Francisco is a unique challenge because they have such a problem with graffiti, and you know, the cabinets provide, you know, they're like little signposts by the, they're like little blank billboards beside the road, and they're
right, and it's a billboard market waiting to be filled in some respect.
Yeah, and they're a very tempting target for the taggers that are out there marking their territory, and that's, you know, I think that's, I get the impression that that's one of San Francisco's principal concerns, is, you know, how do we deal with graffiti and tagging, and there are lots of existing cabinets, and if you drive around San Francisco, you'll see ones that have been painted over and over and over again. You'll see ones with tags on them, and it's really a challenge.
Maybe the city should consider turning the cabinets into a way to foster the creativity of taggers rather than trying to prevent it, and that might, you know, because if you're going to be able to put your own sort of neighborhood, you know, tag signature, if you will, on a cabinet, like legally, well, mm-hmm. number one, what's the fun in that? So that probably would take away some of the, you know, desire. But then it may turn out to be a creative solution to a otherwise mm-hmm. vexing problem. Because, I mean,
well,
when you look at
something...
the benefit of the technology, you know, what we've come down to is that there is a needed piece of the infrastructure. So really what we're talking about is a battle of aesthetics almost more than anything else. So figure out ways to rethink the issue as far as what we're trying to fight or protect against, that kind of thing.
And I think San Francisco has been very forward-thinking in that. You know, you'll see a lot of buildings and alleys in San Francisco where they've encouraged some amazing murals.
Mm-hmm.
And it's definitely the case that if there is a true you know, interaction between the neighborhood and artists, and whether it's buildings or alleys or brick walls or cabinets, you know, if a cabinet has been made part of the neighborhood in an artistic way, I think it's a lot less likely to be getting tagged than if it's just a big beige blank box. You know, that would be, you know, I'm sure there'd be a lot of debate about, you know, who we're going to let paint the cabinets up and what they're going to look like and those sorts of things. And some folks would rather that they sort of disappear in the landscape, you know, being just another beige box that sort of fades away.
Right,
and,
right.
And so, you know, I don't really have a position on that one way or the other. But it's certainly something we're really interested in seeing how the debate turns out.
Mm-hmm. So let's talk a little bit about the community involvement. I mean, as you probably know, I'm a big advocate of community involvement with broadband deployment, because if broadband is to achieve the types of economic goals, the type of healthcare, you know, sort of transition to a 21st century healthcare delivery and so forth, the infrastructure is important, and the best way to ensure that you get the right infrastructure is that you have a voice in the process. I mean, whether it's through public-private partnerships, whether it's through co-ops, so forth and so on, In Sebastopol and potentially in San Francisco, what will be the community's ability to have some sort of influence over how broadband impacts their communities, their respective communities?
Our primary guide for that has been our customers in these communities. And, you know, as I said, in Sebastopol, we serve about 30% of the market. And, you know, the message that we've consistently gotten from customers is we'd like to go faster. And this is particularly pressing, you know, for folks who, you know, they might be on a DSL connection and getting 3 or 6 or less megabits, and they really see that, you know, getting 10 or 20 or 50 or 100 is a key to their enjoyment of the network as a whole. And so, you know, our primary guide for deployment has been, you know, where are our customers that are on the Fusion product today, and, you know, how can we continue to increase the speed for those folks so that they will spread the word, stay on the product, you know, tell their friends and neighbors, and, you know, that's part of the business formula for us. You know, we are a little bit different from other carriers in that we're not heavily pushing a triple play product.
Mm-hmm.
You know, whereas a lot of cable and telco are now, you know, they really want to structure things so that you buy phone, internet, and television. And to such a great degree that, you know, in many cases, at least for the first 6 months or a year, it's cheaper if you take all three than if you don't. You know, taking internet and phone alone would be more expensive. You know, we offer a television product today. We are in partnership with DirecTV on a satellite television product. But, you know, we don't make it an imperative part of the product. There's a bundle discount, $10 a month, but it's nominal, and it doesn't create a forced bundle that's basically imperative that you do both. And I think, you know, one of the things that communities get a little bit frustrated by is, you know, corporations saying, well, you know, here's this bundle of products, we're going to sell you a broadband connection that is crippled by caps, and a phone service that's overpriced, and a TV service that has channels that you don't want, but to get the channels you do want, you got to buy a lot of extra channels, and before you know it, a year or two in, you're writing a check for, you know, $150, $200 every month, and I think that communities get frustrated by that. We have a more simplistic product set, and so we benefit from, you know, having sort of one product, one price all the time. $39.95 is what the vast majority of our customers are buying today, and whether that's on copper or fiber.
Mm-hmm. Now, you and I discussed at the GigaOM event the differences between serving a residential customer base and a business customer base. And I think that in that conversation, you know, I was a little surprised because I felt the business customer was almost the better customer to have because you don't have to deal with issues such as churn, and they're willing to pay more for the service, if, you know, for a premium service, because it's integral to their business. But you had a different take on that. I think we should explore that again for our audience.
Yeah, you know, today we offer copper services to residential and what we would call very small business. So, you know, this Fusion broadband and phone service is available with one or two phone lines for businesses. We'll have a very small business. You know, this will be a cafe, a salon, a restaurant. We'll take that two-line service, and they'll use that to run their business. And they behave, frankly, a lot like a consumer would. They consume a certain amount of internet, and it fits within the normative behaviors and the price point of the product. Our price points in business are slightly higher than residential, so the $39.95 product becomes $49.95, for example, when it's sold to a business. As we've deployed fiber, to date only in residential areas, and we have not deployed to the businesses. And you know, I'm very aggressive and optimistic around you know, not capping consumers and keeping costs in check. But I have some concern about what happens when you provide a gigabit of fiber to a business. And, you know, fundamentally, the consumer's behavior is mostly to consume. They will mostly download things, whether that's streaming video entertainment sort of at the bigger bandwidth side, you know, system updates and apps and software and so on. They're going to click things and get things, and their consumption of that will be constrained by how many screens they have that they're streaming high-def Netflix to, for example, or how many hard drives they have that they're downloading content to. And, you know, fundamentally, eventually they run out of screens or they run out of hard drives, and the amount that they could consume is constrained by those practical realities. When you instead provide a connection to a business and they've got 100 employees or 1,000 employees, it's much more difficult to model typical behavior. You'll have one business that has 5 employees, it's a restaurant, they got 1 or 2 computers, and they're busy serving people and cooking, and they behave a certain way. And then you'll have across the street, you know, a business that's high-tech and doing development. They might build a little data center in their basement, have 10 servers and 50 people, and they'll use a heck of a lot more. And so I'm a little hesitant around the product design for, you know, the mid-size business to large enterprise client with the fiber products, where copper products kind of naturally constrain their ability to create any impact. Fiber products remove those constraints and, you know, make the statistical behaviors more important. So for that reason, to date, we have not designed and deployed a business version of our fiber-to-the-premise product, meaning that it is only a fiber-to-the-home product for now. And I think as time goes by and, you know, we continue to take on more customers in that platform, we'll be revisiting that and thinking about what that should be. You know, I'm real hesitant to put any caps on consumption because, you know, clearly that's a position that we've come out against. But, you know, how do you control costs in an environment where, you know, somebody could set up a little server farm in their basement? And in residential, we have less concerns about that than we would in a business environment.
So is it possible that other providers might piggyback onto your infrastructure to provide that? So, for example, take San Francisco, right? So if you bring in a gigabit service to San Francisco, I am pretty sure that at $70 a pop, it's going to redefine the landscape because people are going to want to buy that service. And you will probably have a lot of entrepreneurs, you know, home-based businesses that will just be, you know, ecstatic and so forth. But clearly there are large businesses in San Francisco, and I think their access to fiber is probably limited in some respect, unless Verizon has done some major, you know, unless the big carriers have put some major fiber stuff in that I'm missing. But would not there be the opportunity for someone to partner with Thonic and then be able to serve those larger business customers?
Well, I'll give you a two-part answer. You know, one is when we sell a gigabit product to a premise for $69.95 with 2 phone lines, we need to sell that product over and over again to premise after premise. So we're going to bar resale. So we wouldn't allow somebody to buy that product and put a wireless antenna on their roof and share it with 100 of their neighbors, because that guts the entire model from the perspective of the need to sell one to each home, so to speak. As to the business customers in San Francisco, today there is broad fiber broadband availability in San Francisco. There is facilities-based fiber from carriers like AT&T itself. We use their infrastructure to sell 1 gigabit and 10 gigabit services to businesses in San Francisco today. There are competitive fiber optic providers like MFN AboveNet and XO Communications, both offering infrastructure in San Francisco. So for many, many businesses that are in sort of the business districts of San Francisco, you know, through, you know, Market Street and the Financial District, through South of Market, down to the data centers, you know, down Turner Paul, 365 Main, there's lots and lots of fiber available. And gigabit, 10 gigabit, and 40 gigabit services are pretty common in San Francisco for businesses today. They're not $70 a month. You know, that price point is dependent upon consumer behaviors that fit within that infrastructure. But gigabit and above gigabit products are available to businesses in San Francisco and most of the Bay Area really broadly today.
Okay, so then let's flip this back around. Let's take the smaller communities, the communities like Santa Rosa and Sebastopol. Is there conflict then in trying to deliver a service in a community that doesn't have those same fiber options for large businesses, but they make up part of the community? Meaning, can I go to a place like Sebastopol where there are maybe 100 small businesses and 5 large and be able to support all of them? Because I think from an economic development standpoint, you know, the city officials at Sebastopol are going to want to support all possible businesses because that represents a boost in the economy for them.
Right. Yeah, and it's an open question, and you know, I think we haven't been doing this long enough to know the answers to the economics around the business case for those larger customers. And you know, I think if folks have the impression that fiber and speeds of gigabit and greater are not available in their communities today, you know, they're mistaken. You know, in every community in the greater Bay Area, we're able to deliver a gigabit or 10 gigabit product today to a business. It's just a very expensive product. What's disruptive about fiber to the home is that it brings it to the home instead of the commercial premise, and that the price point comes down to this much lower level. But you know, fiber at gigabit and above to the business is available in virtually every community in the greater Bay Area and most major metros in the U.S. today. That fiber infrastructure may be the incumbent, it may be an AT&T or a Verizon, it may be a competitor, you know, a Telepacific, an XO, or a Sonic.net. But, you know, businesses often have a choice today. But the economics may not create the kind of business disruption and innovation that you would like to see. And, you know, in other words, you might be getting a gigabit for many, many thousands of dollars instead of hundreds. And, you know, the question is, you know, does that really create disruptive business development?
And when you say disruptive business development, you mean new businesses moving in or new communication service providers moving in?
Well, I think, no, new businesses using the broadband in ways that we might not have imagined. You know, the next Twitter or Facebook or Netflix.
Right.
You know, today, you know, obviously there's no barrier to those businesses starting and existing. You know, they're, I think particularly with the Amazon Web Services platform and cloud computing, you know, there isn't a barrier to people creating well-scaled, large national and international data services. But the question comes down to, you've got a vacant building in community X. I could deliver fiber there, but at 1 gigabit, it's, you know, hypothetically, it's $8,000 a month. Well, does that really further that building getting leased and built out you know, at those sort of price points? And I think that it's through this broader deployment of fiber that we begin to see the cost of its deployment plummet. So instead of stringing one strand out to one specific building and bringing with that a lot of construction costs, you're doing many to many, and through that, achieving economies of scale, and then we may see that the cost of these things drop. But I would say, you know, by and large, the folks that are creating content are going to create it out of cloud computing, You know, whether it's Rackspace or AWS, they're going to create it out of content delivery networks. They're going to create it out of large data centers.
Gotcha.
And whereas consumption is a point of activity, the consumption happens where the people are, you know, where it's end-user consumption. And if we're delivering 100 megabits to a business, is it going to change their business model or behavior versus 1 gigabit to a business that's got 10, 50, 100 people? And I don't know.
Well, I do know that we just ran out of time. And I think we've stopped broadcasting, so I'm not sure if anyone's going to hear my closing comments. But officially, for the record, I will thank you for being here. This has been an extremely informative discussion and one that will probably call you again because I think there's more to be said about this topic and also just finding out how you guys are progressing.
Yeah, so, well, I appreciate the opportunity, Craig. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Take care, and we'll talk soon.
All right. Thanks, Craig. Bye-bye.
Bye.